Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how one systemic computer glitch denied Medicaid coverage for thousands of people who desperately needed it.
The state of Michigan should have known that she was eligible for freedom to work, and it's because she was disabled. But the system did not recognize her disability, and so it just led to this cascade of consequences.
We're going to tell you that story later this hour, but first, if you know anyone who's involved in science or medical research, you may know that the last couple of years have been a roller coaster. You may have gotten a sense of this even if you don't have a connection to science, just from the news. The Trump administration's shakeup of federally funded research appears to be far from over. And this summer, the White House is attempting to fundamentally change the way that federal funding is managed for scientific research. What's hanging in the balance? Several billion dollars of research into natural systems, chemistry, medicine, and so much more. This has been deeply concerning to Michigan scientists who foresee a new level of politically minded control. Michigan Public's senior environment reporter Kate Furby joins me now. Hi, Kate.
Hey, April.
So this change is coming from President Trump's Office of Management and Budget. Just looking at the language, it seems like a small change. Can you explain for us what is said?
Yeah, it's a super dense document that has a lot of stuff packed in there. So it's a proposed rule that's going to revise what's called the Guidance for Federal Financial Assistance, but it would fundamentally change the way that scientific grants are managed. The rule says that it will improve transparency, accountability, and oversight, and ensure that American tax dollars are not wasted. But scientists are concerned that it's going to threaten the peer review process, create instability in federal funds, and create opportunities for arbitrary and maybe even erroneous grant terminations. It's going to limit international collaboration.
Can you maybe give us a little primer on how these traditions about science research funding have typically been made? This is not an area I'm up on.
Yeah, and I think to really understand the impact of this, we kind of have to peel back the curtain on how the science sausage actually gets made. So a big part of this, I think, is the peer review process. So scientists have this expert to expert review process where they submit an application for a grant, and then they actually have unrelated volunteer experts often to review the process itself. So scientists are reviewing each other. It'll be another scientist who's a cancer researcher who's not involved in this particular grant application will be reading the grant and evaluating it and writing down all the reasons why or why not this is good. This is a good idea to fund.
People who understand the field.
Yeah, it's they're running it themselves, kind of scientist to scientist.
So if these changes go into effect, when could we expect that they might be happening?
So it was supposed to, the language said it was going to go into effect October 1st, but the Senate did something interesting. They have effectively, at least temporarily, blocked the ruling by including it in their Continuing Appropriations Act.
So the Senate's not into this?
Not into it.
Yeah.
Not into it. As they should be, because the power of the purse, so to speak, belongs to Congress. Congress is supposed to be the one that controls the Treasury. And this, is OMB sort of trying to expand their power a bit. So Congress, but I guess it's important to say the Senate wrote it into their continuing appropriations bill, but it still has to get through the House. So the House and the Senate are going to come back together at the end of recess and talk about this.
What are you hearing from researchers in Michigan about this possible change?
Yeah, so I talked to a few researchers, and then this rule also went through public comment. So the scientists have a lot to say about this. I talked to Katie Edwards, a professional of social work at the University of Michigan, and here's what she had to say.
This to me is not about saving money. It's not about doing good science. It's about funding things that the administration thinks are worth funding and not other things.
Scientists are concerned that this is going to place increased political pressure on science. So I told you about peer review. So this proposed rule is going to make peer review a secondary thing. And actually, it has language that explicitly says that the decisions will be made by political appointees, not the peer review itself.
Did you speak to anyone who maybe had a grasp on what the long-term implications of this might be?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of concern with Michigan scientists specifically. Long-term research is super important everywhere, but the Great Lakes in particular, scientists are concerned that it's going to affect these long-term data sets we have that help us manage and protect the Great Lakes. So one scientist I talked to, Danny Jones from the University of Michigan, had this to say when I talked to them.
If it becomes harder to sustain these observing systems and these international partnerships, we'll gradually lose our ability to understand and predict what's happening in the lakes. It won't be a big flashy failure necessarily. It probably would look more like just a slow degradation of our ability to observe the lakes, understand, predict, and actually make smart, informed decisions about how to manage them.
Like the lakes are inherently international, inherently collaborative, and also these long-term data sets are critical. And so that is kind of part of what's at stake for this rule.
Right. So you said that there was an opportunity for researchers and just plain folks to weigh in. I kind of got from the way you said that there were a lot of comments.
There were almost 500,000 public comments submitted.
Wow.
Now, you know, they actually have to kind of go through all of the comments and respond to them. So not all of those have been posted yet. So I'm just going to read, like, there's like a fraction of what people had to say, but Michigan scientists specifically were worried that it would seriously interfere with efforts to restore fisheries. It was described as disastrous. Someone said it threatens not only the work to understand our Great Lakes, but also the collaborations that are necessary to ensure that the lakes and people stay healthy. Essential infrastructure is at stake, livelihoods and health. People are not happy.
And our research universities were even commenting on this? That's
yes.
Not something you see every day.
Yeah, University of Michigan submitted a letter, said it would hinder key elements of American innovation. And, you know, they said that OMB's stated goals, it said it wouldn't achieve those either. Transparency, accountability, efficiency, they're saying that'll actually set us back in that respect. And that it was a shift from the prioritization of merit review, the peer review I was talking about, to non-expert political appointees. And they are worried it will jeopardize decades of American leadership.
Kate, can we back up a minute to the procedural aspect of how this is playing out? The Senate, you know, put some very specific language into its bill to fund the government to sort of tie the Office of Management and Budget's hands to stave off from this happening. But did you say there's still a chance that this could move forward in December?
Yeah. I think, like, maybe the way we hear about this the most is how, like, we often hear, like, oh, the government's going to shut down if they don't pass this bill, right?
Right.
So kind of like, this is what we're talking about, and this is where it's kind of gotten written in. And just to take a step back for a second. So, like, every year Congress appropriates a certain amount of money, and then it is part of OMB's job to apportion those amounts of money to federal agencies that then further allocate to specific programs or grants, for example. But because OMB has this new proposed rule that's trying to expand its authority and power over science priorities, the Senate has pushed back. And so they've written into their bill that the ruling cannot be finalized. And they wrote that into their bill, but the House also has their version. And the House did not include that language. And so we will see what happens in the next few weeks and how they reconcile their two different versions.
Kate, I'm sort of just wondering if this really changes the intersection between politics and science. Funding decisions get made in D.C. about these things. I guess on the outside of all this, I just assumed that there is a political aspect to it already. I mean, is it possible that this change, if it happens, would make an inherently political process more transparent with one administrator, you know, saying the buck stops with me and taking the responsibility for funding decisions?
You know, I mean, I think science is inherently political in the same way that it's inherently human. Like, it can't be perfectly objective. It's run by people. However, it does not want to be political. Scientists are invested in trying to find the truth in the world. And the more I talk to them, the more excited they are to be like, hey, here's this thing I discovered. I really want to share it with you. This will take some of that away from them. It'll give political appointees more power. And the thing is that science is occurring on a timescale outside of elections too. So there's this instability that's created if every 2 or 4 years you're dramatically swinging back into what you're allowed to do. Then how is a scientist able to plan more than a couple years in advance? And people's careers and livelihoods are at stake here. In addition, like, the things that we want to know about the world do not exist at these timescales either. When I talked to Danny Jones, the research scientist at the University of Michigan, they had this really great analogy. So they were basically like, if you want to make a medical decision, which let's not forget that medicine is science. So you want to make a medical decision. You want that decision to happen between you and your team of medical professionals, right? Like, you don't actually want the governor of your state to like come in and be involved, like to like have an opinion. Maybe you voted for the governor. Maybe you like the governor. That doesn't mean that you want the governor to decide what your treatment should be. And so for me, that kind of just, that's exactly how it boils down.
Michigan Public's senior environment reporter, Kate Furby. Kate, thank you.
Thanks, April.
We're going to break for just a moment. After that, the tales the bricks can tell us.
If we don't look with excitement and interest and intrigue at everything around us, then you just live somewhere.
We've got an incredible story out of Chicago about the secrets locked into our built environment. We'll be right back with that. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you ever wondered about the kinds of stories that our homes, our schools, the places we work, what stories would they tell if they could talk? I've certainly felt tempted to go to the library and dig up what I can about the place where I live and the people who lived there before me. But one thing I never thought about is what I could learn from the actual structures that make up these places. Maybe that brick that closely hangs from your front is from half a century ago. What about the way it's made and the way it's placed? Could that tell us a story about what the people at the time were thinking and experiencing? Our friends at Points North from Interlochen Public Radio get into it with a brick historian about the things we can learn from our structures. Take a listen.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
What's the name for your tickets?
Yeah.
This is Will Quam.
Elizabeth?
Yes.
There you are. Thanks
Great.
For coming.
Okay, yeah, glad to be here.
Good. That's the right attitude to have about bricks.
Will is standing with a group of people on a sidewalk in Chicago. He's about to lead a tour. A tour of brick.
You guys live in Chicago?
Lakeview.
Great brick neighborhood. Great brick neighborhood.
Will runs a business called Brick of Chicago. He gives these walking tours of brick in different neighborhoods around the city. Basically, this guy really, really loves brick. And he wants you to love it too.
All right, everybody, we are gonna go ahead and get started. If you wanna gather up over here facing this beautiful wall, my name is Will Quam. I'm an architecture photographer and historian, and for 10 years now, I've been obsessed with Chicago's bricks and its neighborhoods and all the wonderful, weird things that make this city what it is.
This is Points North, a podcast about the land, water, and inhabitants of the Great Lakes. I'm Dan Wanshura. Today on the show, how Will Quam got obsessed with brick and how he tries to make you obsessed, too.
It is that dare of, you don't think this can be interesting. It is.
Producer Ryan Schnurr tagged along on one of his tours to find out.
I need to tell you up front, this tour is not just about brick. I mean, it is about brick, but it's also about history and culture and geography and all the messy things brick reveals about a place. It starts like this. 25 people standing around staring at a brick wall. And I have to say, it's a pretty interesting wall. If you're imagining a sort of plain red brick, this is not that. It's rougher and more colorful. Pinks, yellows, oranges, browns.
This is what is called common brick. particular Chicago common brick?
There are basically two major categories of brick in Chicago, common brick and face brick. Common brick was made right here in the city.
Out of our abundant clays that were absolutely riddled and filled with junk. Stones and pebbles and minerals that make some orange, some yellow, some brown, and all these pockmarks to soak up so much soot. So much so that it was considered to be the ugliest brick in the entire world.
So you see common brick mostly on the sides and the back of a building.
And so we imported brick, nice bricks, to cover the fronts of our buildings, to hide our shame.
This is the other brick, face brick. It came from all over the country. Different cities have different kinds of clay, which means different kinds of brick. Detroit's are rustic orange to deep burgundy. Milwaukee's are cream colored. Philadelphia's are a classic smooth red. So Chicago is a collage of all these different places. Today, Will is giving his brick tour in the neighborhood of Old Town. It's a few miles north of downtown Chicago.
All right, we're gonna go over this way to the red brick apartment building.
It's this old Victorian from the 1800s. Old Town has a lot of them. The face brick on these Victorians is often a kind of red press brick. Smooth, consistent color.
Old Town is now frozen, visually, in those early days of the 1870s and the 1880s. But all throughout, there are still these little bits and pieces of all these other eras and people who came through.
Take that first wall. The only reason we see those, quote, ugly common bricks is because all these artists moved in the 1920s and removed the red face brick to expose the Chicago common.
They loved it. It was real and honest and truth and earthy. So that's what they put on the front of the building.
It's a kind of story Kwame tells throughout the tour.
How did you hear about this? Or are you like big brick fans coming into this? Or did you know anything about brick before?
I'm into brick.
Abby Hirschman and Matt Mogensen live nearby. They said they took the tour to learn more about the neighborhood.
I'm from St. Louis, and St. Louis is covered in like beautiful red brick. And he's from Milwaukee, which is like all that like white yellow brick.
Right.
So it's cool to see the in between here.
We also live on the edge of Old Town down there, so it was personal and cool to learn more about the history of the area.
It's personal for Will too. This whole thing started when he moved from Minnesota to Chicago in 2014 to teach theater. He taught a bunch of after-school programs all over the city, so he's traveling around every day from neighborhood to neighborhood, and he starts to notice that the brickwork in Chicago is kind of interesting.
It was kind of this incredible thing where you get the same building in Chicago built side by side over and over and over again, but the brick is what changes.
It wasn't some big epiphany. He was just noticing more than anything. Same sort of building design, different bricks. And then he read a book called On Looking. It was by a cognitive scientist named Alexandra Horowitz. And basically, she wrote about taking these walks around her neighborhood in New York City with different kinds of experts. A geologist, an artist, a sound designer.
And tries to see the world the way that they see it.
What could a geologist see that she didn't? How would it shift and refocus her attention? Would she notice new things?
And I was like, I love that.
Now Will was curious. What would an architect or photographer see when they looked at brick?
And you start to see that, oh, it's not all red. It's not all red rectangle. It can be blue and purple and brown and have crazy textures and be in these patterns. There's so much more going on.
He started snapping photos with his phone and posting them on Instagram on an account he called Brick of Chicago, a kind of riff on the popular account Humans of New York.
I would finish teaching, you know, this hour-long after-school class somewhere, and then I just wander around and take pictures. And it allowed me to engage with and explore every part of the city.
What was the first photo you took for the Brick of Chicago account?
It was my apartment. It was the corner of my apartment. A yellow brick building that had what I now know is vertical scratch brick, so brick with these sort of vertical channels cut into it.
It's got rows of vertical grooves lined up next to each other, like the lines in a barcode. It was used a lot in the early 1900s.
And the corner of the angled bay windows were these limestone blocks.
That you'd never looked at before.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're looking at it now.
I'm looking at it,
for the first time.
Turns out, Will wasn't the only person interested in brick. People started following his Instagram account. Hundreds, then thousands. And they were asking him questions.
And then people would be like, well, I'm seeing this pattern. What's that? I'd be like, I don't know. And so I said, just like read Wikipedia and start looking into things.
And what he found was that brick revealed so much about Chicago's history.
It's like going abroad and suddenly being able to understand the language everyone's speaking, except it's suddenly being able to understand what is happening on every single building around you. All right, this is St. Michael's Catholic Church. You know it's Saturday because there's a wedding at St. Michael's. There's a wedding here every single Saturday all year long.
Case in point, St. Michael Church. It's this beautiful, ornate, Romanesque building. Tall spire, arched windows. It's made of limestone and brick.
The original church was a wood church, and in the 1860s, they started construction on a brick church, finishing it just in time for the Great Fire to sweep through and knock everything but the sidewalls down.
St. Michael used to be the tallest building in Chicago, and it was one of only a few buildings to survive the fire that consumed the city in 1871. Well, the brick parts did. After the fire, St. Michael was rebuilt.
But what you see today is not exactly that same church.
It got a facelift in 1913. And he could tell, of course, because of the brick.
If it was 1870s, it would be probably that smooth red pressed brick.
Like the Victorians.
Instead, what it is this beautiful brown, purpley, bluey brick.
Iron spot brick. It comes from clay with a lot of iron pyrite.
And when it's fired, the impurities at the surface burst and speckle and vitrify, turn to glass across the face of the brick. And what that means too, if we go over here, is when you get up close to the wall and touch it, what you're seeing is iron. All those specks and spots is metal on the face of the brick. Architects in the early 20th century loved this iron spot brick because it looked so earthy and real compared to those older generation of red, perfect bricks.
Frank Lloyd Wright even used iron spot brick on his prairie-style homes.
It's also my favorite kind of brick. If you take my Rogers Park tour, you can actually see my favorite wall of my favorite brick and my favorite brick on my favorite wall of my favorite brick.
He holds up a picture of a wall with iron spot brick. All 25 of us come in closer, and right in the middle of the image is a brick with a splash of blue and purple across the front, like a hot flame.
That one right there. That one right there. You get it. You get it. It's like an oil slick on water. It's just so full of life.
I'm gonna be on the lookout for iron spot brick everywhere now. Just call it out. See the little gray hues.
Matt and Abby say they're already seeing their neighborhood differently, with expert eyes. They're seeing the hidden common brick. They're seeing the different face brick.
And now I can not unsee it on every building.
I feel like every time I go on a tour like this, it's a good way to become insufferable to everyone else around you. You know, then you're walking around.
Can't wait. Can't wait till the parents come visit. We're going to inundate them with brick facts.
When Will first began giving tours in 2018, he was doing just a few per month in the summer. It was all pretty low key. He'd post about them on neighborhood Facebook groups.
And I would bring some bricks in my bed, a backpack, because I had started collecting them.
So and you're carrying around these physical bricks.
Yeah, like three or four in a backpack.
How much does a brick weigh?
Too much.
Yeah.
But those early tours were very much like, we are only talking about bricks. And I'm going to teach you all about bricks.
Then COVID hit. Teaching ground to a halt. No middle school theater. The brick tours moved online, and Will expanded his research beyond the building materials themselves. He was connecting the dots between design and era, but also the kinds of people who lived there, and even the cultural and political landscape of the neighborhood.
And that was this sort of incredible, like, oh, wow.
It changed what he was doing with the tours.
And that's one where I really started pulling in a lot of these stories that I was finding, and that people really enjoyed that.
So the brick is like an...
It's a gateway drug.
It's a gateway drug. Brick, it's an on-ramp.
Yeah, exactly.
In 2021... theater started up at schools again, and Will went back to teaching, but it wasn't the same.
The spark was kind of gone, you know, around it.
He was hooked on bricks, and the demand for tours was there, so he went full time.
I still love the kids and I miss the kids a lot. But I was like, you know what? This is what I'm going to do.
These days, he runs about 150 tours a year. The essence of the tour, he says, is story. The story of the neighborhood as told through brick.
So this here, my favorite streetscape in Chicago, or one of them. Notice the chop in the corner of the building here?
We're a block down from St. Michael Church. Will motions to a brick building. It's pretty plain overall, but the corner, or what would have been the corner, has been cut off at a 45 degree angle. And there's a reason.
We are standing in the middle of Ogden Avenue.
Or where Ogden Avenue used to be. It's gone now.
Ogden Avenue used to come right through here, right through where we are.
Ogden ran diagonally across the grid of city blocks. And so when this brick building was constructed, a corner would have stuck out into the street. So they just angled the front. It's technically called a chamfer, if that helps you picture it. It probably doesn't. But anyway, the street was removed in 1968.
Now, 1968, the year they took out the street, is not quite coincidentally also the year the Chicago Housing Authority built the William Green Towers in Cabrini Green at Division and Ogden.
The housing project was about a mile down the road. It had low-income residents, most of them black, who had been excluded from other housing opportunities. The wealthy white people in Old Town didn't like being so close to that development.
And if you have developed and poured money into this historic neighborhood and you're terrified of your neighbors, what do? Take out the streets. Make it a lot harder for any of them to come where you don't want them.
Removing the street created a barrier between the north and south sides of Old Town. It became much more difficult to drive from one area to the other. It's not so obvious now. If Will hadn't pointed it out, most of us would never have guessed a street used to cut through here. It would have missed the story of racist urban planning that shaped this area. The last stop on the tour is a street corner with buildings showcasing different eras.
All right, so from this spot here, we can really see the full history of Old Town.
1880s. 1920s, 1970s, and on. 250 years in a snapshot. And when the tour ends, people just kind of hang around, standing on the brick sidewalk, talking about bricks.
It's like cool to have someone like walk you around and kind of like point out the different layers of time in all of these buildings, so.
We live in New York, but I'm an architect, and so getting to know a new city through the architecture on the scale of not just a house, but of a brick has been really cool.
I feel like I pass through areas and I'm just like, I don't really think about the historical aspect of things.
And also like a neighborhood that has so many different little pockets of times and styles is just really cool.
The assignment now, I think, is for everybody to find their own favorite brick.
Yeah, this is a good homework assignment.
Are you doing multiple of these tours with him?
This is our second. We're going to do them all at some point.
Collect
You're
them all.
Yeah, them
break.
All.
But this is my new goal.
If we don't do this, if we don't look with excitement and interest and intrigue at everything around us, then you just live somewhere. But if you're going to be in the city and take part in the city, you celebrate the things that are still here and the people that are still here. And you tell these stories and like keep these stories alive. As long as you know how to see it, you can find it. And that, my friends, is the end of our tour. Thank you so much for joining me today.
That story was produced by Ryan Schnurr. Morgan Springer is our editor. Our senior producer is Ellie Katz. And I'm Dan Wanchura, host and executive producer. We got production assistance on this episode from Peter Payette. Special thanks to Travis Pope and Brianna Data Barrow at WBOI. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. Will Quam came out with a book this spring. It's called Fire and Clay: How Bricks Reveal the Hidden History of Chicago.
We're going to pause for just a moment now. After that, a woman from Brighton with a medical condition trying to work.
So I was in a unique position where I literally could not get health insurance if it were not for this, the program that I have through the Freedom to Work, which is returning to work with a disability. And that was literally my last hope.
That story's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A recent investigation from KFF Health News found that Deloitte-run systems has denied Medicaid to people with disabilities in Michigan. Reporting found that this was largely due to IT issues that have not properly assessed eligibility plans for people with disabilities. People like Marie Noon. Marie lives in Brighton. She was eligible for Medicaid through a program that provides coverage to disabled adults who work. But the state's computer system did not register that she is, in fact, disabled, and last year denied her application for Medicaid benefits. With the One Big Beautiful Bill Act about to significantly change Medicaid eligibility, these new laws may further strain the system. Marie has joined us now to talk about her experience with losing Medicaid, and we've also invited KFF senior correspondent Rachana Pradhan to talk about how the system has hurt Michiganders. Marie Noon, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Rachana, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Marie, let's start with you. More than 10 years ago, you got this diagnosis for adult onset Still's disease. This was a new condition for me reading up, but I understand the managing of it is pretty intense. Can you tell us a little bit about your condition and what it requires?
Yeah, so it shares a lot of similarities with like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis most commonly. It causes pain and swelling in the joints. It causes rashes. In fact, when I was first diagnosed, I had had a fever of 104 for over 2 weeks. And then the rash appeared and I couldn't even stand the like fabric touching my body. It was so incredibly painful. It's not easily managed with like one specific drug. It's kind of a whole combination of things that that you have to just find the one that works for you. Mine was a combination of medications and supplements that seems to have done the trick, but it was about 6 months initially where I couldn't even get out of bed. I just cried all day. It felt like my joints were literally being torn apart.
Yeah. Rachana went into some detail about how you'd been in and out of the hospital several times as your team was trying to get this nailed down for what was wrong with you. But I did get the sense that you are able and have been working for most of your adult life and for some time since your diagnosis. Is that right?
Yes. Yep. I've been working since I was 15 and also a busy mom. I have two kids who are grown now, but when I was first diagnosed, they were at their busiest, middle school and high school. So, and I was on all of their, I was like the coaches and the different things. I was very involved. So very busy at work, very busy with the kids. And then when I was diagnosed, my life was pretty much brought to a standstill until I mean, 6 months solid of zero improvement. So I was really terribly sick and couldn't do much of anything. And then it was like 8 years before it was managed well enough where I could go back to work. But I am now back to work full time and busy as ever.
And I think it may be a surprise to some people to know that there are folks who are on Medicaid who do hold down jobs. But I mean, this appears to be something that would be important to your being able to work, being able to manage your care.
Absolutely. It's the medications I take are very expensive. And with all of the things going on, especially right now, the cost of those can fluctuate by hundreds of dollars every month. It can be different all the time. And I never know if I'm going to have to go to a doctor's visit or a specialist or end up in the hospital. And most of the time, whenever I was in the hospital, it was for weeks at a time. So all of those things make it terribly important that I have medical coverage. Something interesting about that, though, when you have disability, you get Medicare from the date when your case begins. But when you go back to work, all of that cancels except for Part A. And you can't get insurance through anywhere else when you have Part A because you're covered under Medicare technically. And you can't cancel it because they will cancel your case retroactively back to the date when you applied, which created a catch-22. I could have insurance through my employer if my employer offered insurance, but they don't. If you try to get it through the marketplace, you can't because you don't qualify. So I was in a unique position where I literally could not get health insurance if it were not for this, the program that I have through the Freedom to Work, which is returning to work with a disability. And that was literally my last hope, to have health insurance.
Rachana, let's go over to you for just a minute. Your reporting has focused on a system through which the state government, in this case, Michigan, tries to determine who's eligible for what and what kind of coverage program they belong in. And in this case, we're talking about a contractor called Deloitte that designs the technology used in these Medicaid services. When we say that Deloitte is supplying technology to states for Medicaid, can you maybe break down for us exactly what Deloitte is providing, what services it's creating?
Sure. So, and these things are complicated, as you pointed out. So what happens in every state in this country is when someone applies for Medicaid coverage, ultimately the state is the one that will say, okay, you're eligible or you are not eligible. But in the middle of that, those two bookends, is this messy, complex, complicated process of figuring that out, right? Are you or aren't you? And in that middle space is where consulting companies like Deloitte sit. Deloitte is a company that dominates this very important slice of government business, because at least 25 states have awarded this company contracts to run the IT systems that ultimately control access to safety net benefits, Medicaid, a lot of the time SNAP, otherwise known as food stamps and other things. So what they're doing is they are designing these complex data IT systems, implementing them, running them, maintaining them for state government, because state government is often under-resourced and they can't do this alone, especially with the volume of Medicaid enrollees in this country and the complicated factors that go into determining whether someone is eligible. As you can see with Marie's case, she told me, and an attorney who helped her told me, the state of Michigan should have known that she was eligible for Freedom to Work, and it's because she was disabled, but the system did not recognize her disability. And so it just led to this cascade of consequences that resulted in this denial letter that Marie got last year saying, sorry, no. And Michigan is not the only place where we've seen this happen.
Marie, how did you find out last year that you'd lost your Medicaid benefits?
I actually changed jobs, and I had an employer where my health insurance was through my employer. My new employer did not offer health insurance. So I went onto the marketplace and I applied for insurance, and I had it for about a month when I got a letter saying, you still have Medicare, so you're not eligible, and we're canceling your policy. So at that point, I was like, well, this has to be a mistake. I've been back to work for years. So then we're like, well, we'll just get this straightened out. So I called, and Medicare said, nope, you still have it, and you're eligible through 2029 to have that. And I said, well, I don't need it. Can I just cancel it? And they said, if you do, it cancels your case all the way back to the date you applied, which means you have to repay all of the medical and financial benefits you've received, which I received legitimately. So there I was like, okay, well, if I can't do that, then what can I just get back on the full Medicare program? And they said, well, no, that you have to have a qualifying circumstance. And I said, well, I changed jobs. Shouldn't that qualify? And they said it would qualify if you were canceled from an employer's health plan, but you had the Affordable Care health insurance, and that doesn't qualify you as a qualifying circumstance. So no.
Holy bureaucratic nightmare.
It really was. And so I went down to the DHS office. I went to the Medicare office and I explained, like, there has to be some way for me to get health insurance. I asked if I could get private health insurance, and I was told the premiums would be about $800 a month and they won't cover pre-existing conditions. So that wouldn't have helped me anyway. And in both of those offices, they even got supervisors and they were like, we're sorry. I can see what the problem is, but we can't fix this for you. I'm really sorry. And I had honestly given up at that point. And then I just randomly bumped into someone who said, well, you should try a lawyer because you definitely qualify. Something's wrong. And that's how I ended up finding the attorney who helped me. And she said, she sent me the information about Freedom to Work and helped me with the language to start the appeals process. And I had to appeal two or three times before I finally had success and won the appeal and got the insurance coverage. But I was without insurance coverage all that time.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Brighton resident Marie Noon, who is a working person and disabled, and whose coverage through Medicaid was canceled due to an IT failure, and Rachana Pradhan, who reports for KFF Health News. Rachana, can you tell us a little bit about how you've seen similar situations playing out across the country? I mean, how did you come to realize that this eligibility issue repeating was due to an IT problem?
Well, first, I should say, you know, my colleagues, Samantha Liss is one of the other reporters on the story with me, and she and I have been pursuing this topic, like I said, for at least 2 years. We started looking at it probably in 2023, because we knew, look, there's been a long history of problems throughout the nation, and not just on Medicaid benefits, but on other safety net benefits that are administered through state government, where people have their benefits canceled, where they're not approved, even though they're eligible, et cetera. And so we knew that when we first looked into it, we saw the scope of problems just going back years. And a lot of it sort of coincides with, we've talked about the Affordable Care Act, which was a huge lift for state governments. It changed Medicaid and other health insurance systems in a really big way. And it made things very complicated, and state government really had to make a lot of changes at their level to all of a sudden determine whether millions more people qualified for, especially for Medicaid benefits, right? Like millions of people got access who hadn't had it previously. But so there have been lawsuits. In particular, there's a class action one in Tennessee, and similar problems affecting Medicaid eligibility for people with disabilities was at the heart of this class action suit in Tennessee. And actually, in 2024, a federal judge ruled in the plaintiff's favor, who were Medicaid beneficiaries in that state. So it's been a very long road. And we realized in 2024, when we did some earlier reporting about Deloitte in particular, that we came across some issues in Michigan. And so we knew that there were 2 years ago. That's how long this took to get to the at least kind of the bottom of it, where we knew that there was something to go back to that we needed to look into more, because we kept hearing about issues, ultimately the ones that you see in the story. One, and they're both, they center on people with disabilities, but they deal with issues like the one that Marie had, where she was applying for Medicaid and was just denied outright for coverage, and also other people who were, instead of being denied outright, they were sort of funneled into a Medicaid programs that offer very limited coverage. So it's not comprehensive health coverage that would cover your doctor's visits and your prescriptions and sort of broad-based medical care, but very narrow, like family planning, sexual health services, birth control, even people who, you know, would say they're not at the age where they would need birth control, and yet they were still getting enrolled in it, and they would raise all these questions, right? So that's how we came to Michigan, is we knew that there was something bigger to tell about this state. But like I said, it's far from an isolated problem, you know, to this state.
Rachana, you mentioned that the states have really been all the way down the rabbit hole and back with the Affordable Care Act, that was a huge change and kind of set the stage for what's going on now. So here we are as the states are preparing for more changes, the biggest in years due to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. What have you been hearing from your sources about the future of these technical issues as the kind of, for lack of a better term, sorting that Deloitte provides has been really critical to the administration of Medicaid?
So I think what is about to happen is, for context for your listeners, in case they don't remember, I don't expect anyone to remember the details of legislation or their names, but you know, this law, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, was President Trump's sort of signature tax and domestic policy law that he signed into law in July of 2025. And what that law largely does is it puts on many more restrictions on Medicaid and food stamp benefits. It is projected to strip health insurance from millions of Americans in the coming years by ultimately you know, making it harder, adding red tape and making it harder for them to qualify for benefits. So since then, since July of 2025, state governments have known that they need to make all these upgrades to these same IT systems to account for all these new restrictions and new rules and additional verifications that they're going to need to do. Some of those changes actually affecting food stamps already started in 2025. And so they've been working through that. That's sort of the first tranche of things. The big Medicaid changes and restrictions really are starting to take effect later on this year. Really major ones are going to start in 2027. And the biggest one of those is that millions of adults who receive Medicaid coverage now are going to have to show that they are working at least 80 hours a month to keep their benefits. But I think if history shows, most adults who have Medicaid coverage are already working. So it's not a question of whether they are working. It is, does the system register that they're working? And it'd be one thing if these systems worked properly and were smooth and without glitches. And so, but they're not. We know they're not. So I think what the people we talked to have said is that already you have these pre-existing problems. You have these issues, these glitches, these things that deny people benefits in error. And now you are overloading these states with all these changes that they have to make pretty quickly, right? A year and a half is not a long time in this space. And it's probably going to get worse because it's the same IT systems that need to now account for all these different additional rules and restrictions and some things that they've never done before, like having to verify employment for as many people as they're about to do. So I think that, again, it's a crystal ball answer in some respects that I'm giving you, but I think that we have some basis to sort of, you know, think that these things have the potential to get worse.
Rachana Pradhan has been one of my guests. She writes for KFF Health News and has published recently on systems run by Deloitte that are administrating Medicaid among Michiganders who may qualify. We've also been speaking with Marie Noon. She lives in Brighton and has been receiving Medicaid because of her disability. Rachana, Marie, thank you so much, both of you, for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
Thank you so much.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.